Rebel Force Radio presents
Hey, Star Wars fans, Jimmy Mack here with you, and welcome back to another edition of the Babu Freaks. The Babu Freaks have returned for 2025. So, hide the women. I wanted to do my thing where I introduce everyone before anyone
speaks. How much for the women?
Joining us this time around on the Babu Freaks, as always, is Babu Freak Tyler Page.
Hey, hey.
Barry Harmon.
Hey, hey.
Brian Klein.
Hey, hey.
And myself, Jimmy Mack.
Hey, hey. Hey.
That was a very SNL intro.
Hey, hey.
I want to do that every week now where we're just like...
Yeah, Barry, you and I, we can't both do finger guns. So
yeah, maybe we'll get into a finger gun shootout and one of us dies.
Pew, pew, indeed. Well, next time I'll just do the whole intro as Don Pardo.
Yeah.
So that'll put everyone in the book. It's the Babu Freaks.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I just caught that SNL music documentary. I haven't finished it yet.
Yeah.
It's good from what I've seen so
far. I'm sure it is because I saw the other... there's a four-part documentary out there on Paramount Plus. It's really good. And like one entire part of the documentary, I think it's part three, is about nothing but the cowbell sketch with Christopher Walken. And the last documentary is all about the weird season from 1985 where they had Robert Downey Jr. and Anthony Michael Hall, Randy Quaid.
Yeah.
It was just an odd year where they had like non-comedians on a very comedic show. But it's very good. I also saw the movie, the Saturday night movie.
I just saw that.
Yeah. What'd you think?
Yeah. It was good, but it's very like surface level. Like I actually wish it was a like an 8-part series where like it was the same 90 minutes retold from different perspectives.
Oh,
I think that would be a really cool concept. And I haven't seen the Godfather documentary yet or miniseries.
Oh, The Offer?
Yeah, but yeah, I feel like they could have done something probably similar to that. But I like Saturday Night. The back of my head, though, I just kept thinking of Baby Belushi, though.
Well, the guy they got to John Belushi, a guy named Matt Wood.
Yeah.
No relation to the General Grievous Skywalker sound, Matt Wood.
Yeah, I know.
But, this guy, he did a pretty good job, I thought. But again, like you said, Barry, very surface level.
Yeah.
Almost to a cartoony level. it felt very
cartoony
at times. And, but I appreciate it, knowing the story largely, knowing the players that these guys are trying to portray and all that, and being very aware of Saturday Night Live. I thought it was all right. Yeah.
I thought the Chevy Chase actor, even though he doesn't look like him, he has the mannerisms down in the voice. I thought he did a great job.
Yes. Yes, he did.
And best scene was the J.K. Simmons as Milton Berle having that confrontation with Chevy Chase, even though that probably didn't happen.
Yeah, it was kind of disturbing, too. But it was, I didn't know that was J.K. Simmons until the credits rolled. And I had a, like, holy crap sort of moment when I realized that that was J.K. Simmons, whose career I've been following since Oz.
Yeah.
That Drumline movie he did, Whiplash, was so flipping good.
It was great.
And then, of course, his turns in the superhero movies. He was J. Jonah Jameson. And was he Perry White ever as well? Did he do the double?
No.
That would be double.
He was Commissioner Gordon in
That's right. He was a good Gordon, too. He looked like he was straight out of the comic books with that mustache.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
He got jacked for that movie, man.
Yeah.
For an older guy, man. They showed him. I'm like, holy cow.
Well, remember in Spider-Man 2, they had the deleted scene where he puts on Spider-Man's costume, and the joke would have been like, oh, look at this out-of-shape middle-aged guy in Spider-Man suit. And he put it on, and he, like, looked the part. Like, he had, like, a six-pack, and they were like, well, this isn't funny. It makes it makes him look really good.
Yeah, move over, Tom Holland.
Yeah.
There's a new Spidey in town.
Yeah, the musical documentary, from what I saw, it's from Questlove. And he edits it almost like a music video. It's really interesting. The first 8 minutes are like a supercut of SNL musical performances, but like mixed together. And it's really interesting.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out. Yeah.
I've been enjoying it. I really recommend it just based on the first 20 minutes. So
awesome. It's amazing that that program has like introduced me to so many different artists and musicians over the years, because it's the type of show that really seems to have a knack at grabbing talent right as they are starting to emerge and become something notable.
Yeah.
And so I think for a lot of people, their first taste of these individuals all come through Saturday Night Live, which is amazing. You know, I mean, you have to have some level of success just to be on the show, but I'm not, you know, I don't exactly have my finger on the pulse of like pop music and hip hop and things like that. So I get introduced to a lot of these musicians via SNL.
Yeah. There's also a lot of times too, if you look back at some of the shows where it's just like, wow, that was like a moment in time type thing where that band was there for then. And then it was just like, a year before, no one knew who they were. A year later, they were like
off the map.
Yeah. I remember what was the one? Oh, Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians was on. And they were like so, you know, hot because they had the big YM song. And she was married to, I think, Paul Simon. And it was the big hit. And then all of a sudden, it was just like, they're gone.
Yeah, so. But, you know, that album of hers had a lot of legs and is one of like the top selling LPs of all time.
It hit, yeah, I think as far as like the popular, you know, culture type thing, it's
well, as far as sales go, is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that album of hers was like a record breaker as far as sales go. You know, if you ever look at those lists on like the albums that have sold the most and stuff, there are a few surprises in there. Mm-hmm. You know, a few moments where you go, oh, I remember them, and so that kind of fits into your description of these SNL bands that they come and they go and you never hear from them again. And
no, especially if you show like the ones just like American, because there's a big discrepancy, like because it pops up a lot of times where it's like the top selling albums of all time worldwide and then in America, because there's a huge difference, because it's like, I think like in the top 20 of all time, you've got Alanis Morissette and Hootie and the Blowfish and then Sync album and a Backstreet Boys album. And then the rest of them are like Eagles, Michael Jackson, AC/DC, Fleetwood Mac. It's like the cornerstone things, Beatles. But sometimes it's just like, yeah, there's that one band that's like, who was it I saw? I think like the first Matchbox 20 album sold like 18 million copies. And all their other albums combined haven't even sold like 10 or something like that.
They sold 17 million of those albums to Tyler alone. He really put that band on the map.
But that's why I got these boxes. You know, I got all this stuff in my house.
Are those the matchboxes themselves, sir? I see them all behind you.
Yeah.
What else you got back here? I want to look at Tyler's place for a second.
It's getting more acceptable as a living situation.
I see a Mace Windu bust behind you.
And yep.
Oh, it looks like you're working on a Mace Windu display of some sort.
Yeah, Mace is my favorite.
Nice.
So I have very new. I was going to do this. I've got like probably 15 different Mace figures.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to figure out, in this little Detolf thing, if I want to keep them carded or not, because putting a card inside of a glass cabinet, it just seems like overkill to me, to be honest.
Well, if one of them is like worth some money, I'd keep it carded. But the other ones, I mean, you know, even if they say they're worth $20, good luck finding a buyer for some of this stuff, because there's just been so many of them made. So I say rip them off the card.
Right now, live.
I'm always trying to corrupt mint in package collectors. I'm always trying to do that.
I did that recently when I moved. I had a lot of carded like Sonic and Sega toys, and they took up so much space. And then when I unbox them and all, they take up like, I could fill a Ziploc bag with them and that's it. And I'm like, these things were filling up like 6 comic book long boxes.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
like how I was storing them. And now I'm like, man, I got so much space.
That's how Swank stores them. is in the comic book long boxes, and his collection's outrageously organized. It's
I'll bet
in such good shape. And then there's Brian Klein, who has enough carded action figures probably to pay off the mortgage on his house if he ever decided to go to eBay.
And that's I have a carded figure from the start of Power of the Force 2, every single released one.
You do?
Until now, Clone Wars, Resistance, everything. Minus when they went and did like the greatest hits and then the Saga collection. The only time I got the Saga cards was when, because those were like the 30th anniversary style cards, is when there was a figure that was like only available before, like the one droid that came with the Sandcrawler was never carded, but it was carded on this thing. So I got that carded figure. And then some of like the battle droids, they have different paint decos. But yeah, it's when it's in the new house, when it's all said and done, there's not going to be enough wall space to put them all. Because I have them all in pro cases too. So
when you were on MeTV at Eric Pfeiffer's house,
right?
That wall that he has that's just completely carded figures, it does worry me. I don't know why. I hate it. Like I did something similar like that at my last apartment, and it wasn't like a full wall.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like
you didn't like the look of it.
Yeah. Like visually you can't look at it if it's like 20 feet up.
I experienced that a lot. Like I know guys who have huge collections, either Star Wars or other things I'm interested in. And I'm not envious so much as I'm ticked off because they're the worst at displaying things. Uh-huh. They know how to own and buy and collect.
Yeah.
They don't know how to display. And I'm like, it looks awful. Mm. You know.
To me, it's all about the display.
Yeah.
I collect to display. I mean, let's just face it. I don't collect to stuff stuff into a box and put it in my attic and forget about it. Because then I feel like sad that the collection isn't being appreciated or enjoyed by anyone. I just feel like some creepy old hoarder doing things like that. So I tend to, I rip things off the card with no mercy. No mercy whatsoever. I recently acquired this guy, and I can't get enough of him. It's Kersantan retro version. Okay. It's the first retro version action figure that I really, really liked.
Is that new?
I don't know when this came out. I just saw it on Amazon.
That's from the book of Boba Fett retro line.
Yeah. I just saw him on Amazon, and I thought, wow, he's cooler than the other one that they did for the 3¾ inch. Line. So I enjoy him very much. He's become quite a companion, confidant, and occasional lover. Not for air.
If anyone wants the deluxe version of that and the vintage collection, the Ollie's by my place has like about 40 of them for like $7.99.
All right.
The Chrysanthemums. So
really? Well, I know I got him for a really good price on Amazon. It was like $10, you know, so not bad. It saves me a trip to Ollie's at least, so worth it to me. I've never been to an Ollie's before. I hear people talk about Ollie's all the time, and I feel like I live in an Ollie's desert. There's no Ollie's.
I think there's one in either Bloomingdale or where's the IKEA that's south? That's like
Schaumburg.
Bolingbrook. I think they're opening one. Pretty much what an Ollie's is like an overstock. It's all the stuff that they don't sell at other places, and they get them you know, there. Although I think some of the people like I was showing these guys in our group, I bought 5 of the May hologram Walmart exclusive holler things because they were $2 a piece. That's worth it just for the glowing, you know, the stand or the holocom edition or whatever.
Is this a Black Series thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
$2. I got the Darth Maul one here, which is basically like the Solo figure, which is a Target exclusive. I wasn't going to pay $35 for it. They have it right now for $6.99. So,
oh, wow. Nice. I didn't see it for that much, but
sometimes it pays to be patient.
Yeah.
It really
otherwise
does.
I'm like, This one works because it was a hologram at the end of Solo. Those other figures, like the Han Solo one or the May ones, they're never you never see them on screen, like X-Wolves. You never see them on that the holocom thing or hologram.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of like pointless. So
I want a little Newt Gunray, right? Because didn't he appear as a hologram when he's like, our forces are ready, you know, there in the
swamps.
Yeah,
when he's talking to Sidious and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I want that. But he doesn't even have a Black Series figure or a recent vintage collection, does he?
Newt.
No. Needs one. Newt.
Not in this episode.
They've been coming out with, the Black Series. It has a lot of, prequel stuff coming out, with Shaak Ti and Luminara Unduli, and they're doing a lot of the old Jedi Council members, which is kind of cool. So I would love to see a Black Series like Yariel Poof, because that thing would have to be about 12 inches tall.
We'll see. Head. Maybe that's the big Japan reveal. As soon as I see him, I'll send pictures of Yariel Poof.
You're going to Japan for Star Wars. We got a man on the inside here.
I'm planning. Your recording time, usual recording time is 9 a.m. for me. So.
Yeah, that's right. Tokyo is, I believe, 16 hours ahead of Chicago.
So in the future. I plan to take photos, video, and I'll send those all your way.
Good, good. You know, the coverage of Star Wars, the original Star Wars Celebration Japan from 2008, there's very limited coverage on any of the fan sites or anywhere, YouTube, anywhere.
Yeah.
And I know I have some video. I should find all that stuff and digitize and get it online, because I think I was the only American there actually recording and taking photos of things. So I do have full panel recordings of Mark Hamill's panel. I walked Mark Hamill onto the stage for his panel at Star Wars Celebration Japan. It was the coolest flipping thing. I was still interviewing him as he's walking out of the stage. I'm walking out with him, you know. It was such a surreal moment, but he just wanted to keep talking. And then he got up on stage and did a really funny panel. And what's amazing is that I was there with Dan Curto, who was a guy that I worked with at rebelscum.com. And Mark was telling jokes up on stage at Star Wars Celebration Japan, and there were very few English-speaking people there at that convention. That's how I got to know a lot of people at Lucasfilm, is because all the English-speaking people tended to stick together, you know? And so I met a lot of people. That's where I met Filoni for the first time. And when Mark was on stage, me and Curto were sitting there in the audience, and Mark would talk, and then the translator would repeat what Mark said in Japanese. But when Mark would tell a joke, me and Curto would be the only people in the auditorium laughing. And then we would wait for the translation, and then everyone would laugh. And then we'd laugh again with the translation, because we knew what the joke was, but we didn't understand the translation. Well, we just wanted to fit in, you know?
That's great.
At one point, an earthquake hit. An earthquake, there were probably three earthquakes on this trip for me. And, you know, being a flatlander from Illinois, earthquakes are kind of foreign to us. Luckily, I spent a lot of time in L.A., so I got used to them. I was out there in L.A. for all the aftershocks in 94, I think it was, when they had that really big earthquake out there. And so I was relatively used to it, but still, it's not anything I commonly experience. So when the earthquakes hit, me and Curto are the only ones in the audience freaking out. Everyone else is just sitting there calm and cool, like it's, you know, a typical experience for them, which it probably is. But those are the things, you know, to make yourself look like the American outsider in Japan, is freak out at an earthquake and laugh at the English jokes before the translation, and people will know where you're from and who you are. So I anticipate many more English-speaking people will be out there this time around.
For sure.
It sure seems like a lot of people are, the whole Star Wars Celebration culture has elevated to a much higher level than it was in 2008.
Right. And, I don't want to make the comparison, but I will. There's almost like Disney adult.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they like Star Wars, but they are all in on Celebration every year.
Yeah, and that's cool. No matter where it is.
But, yeah.
Which is amazing to me.
Yeah.
But I got to say that when the first Star Wars Celebration was announced in Denver back in 1999, the concept for me of like getting on an airplane to go somewhere for Star Wars was completely a foreign idea. I mean,
yeah.
I never gave a second thought to going to Denver, but it ended up, I did know some people from Illinois who did make that trip. I found out afterwards, you know, and then the next few were in Indianapolis. So that was a no-brainer. Just hop in a car and take the 3-hour drive, which I did with Billy Mack twice. And got, you know, Richard LaParmentier swore at us, and we were in a lot of places we weren't supposed to be in, because the security, the whole culture around Star Wars Celebration was real loosey-goosey back then. And for conventions in general, you know, the celebrities were all super accessible, and they would hang out in the hotel bars. I mean, I know they still do that now. But, yeah, you know, sharing a drink with Kenny Baker because he's plopped up on a bar stool. And then, you know, Anthony Daniels running around telling people to keep it down so he could hold a conversation. All these nerds crammed into a hotel bar.
Barry, did you buy any photo ops and get charged $45,000?
What? 45,000 yen?
Wait, what?
They you guys heard about this. I'm sure Barry.
No. I haven't.
They missed someone over at Reed Pop. Instead of charging like a foreign currency exchange, so they were charging you like instead of 45,000 Japanese yen, they were charging you like 45,000 U.S. dollars.
Worth it. Worth every
people's
penny.
Credit cards and it was just declining.
Oh my God!
And it happened to a lot of people. So,
yeah.
Wow.
But
no,
yet,
I haven't. Thankfully, I haven't booked anything. I'm not an autograph or photo guy. Like I have hardly ever paid for an autograph. And the first and last time I did, I felt so weird about it. I was like, I was talking to someone at their booth and I brought something for them to sign. And then I looked at the prices and I was like, really? I'm just dropping $50 on this guy. I wasn't prepared for that. Like I'm spoiled. I speak to so many like notable people that I look up to, and autographs have always been free. And maybe just because I haven't been in the convention circuit, it's more like I'm interviewing them or we're at like a shared event and they are happy to just do it. And I get that's how they make their money, but I just feel weird about it.
It's more special if you like run into them. Like that's a better story than like, oh, I waited in line and paid $200.
You know? Right. That's why I love the Rebel Force Radio events, because like you get to mingle with people and sure you're not signing autographs or doing like official photo sessions, but they'll you know pose for a picture and you know it's cool. And you get to have I'd rather have a conversation with someone who worked on the movies than just like pay them for their autograph and move along.
I always like getting, when I would interview someone, I would always like to get their autograph, and I always paid for it too, because I wanted to, you know, to give them something in return for the time they granted me. And I always felt weird. And then a lot of times people would refuse to accept, you know, but I always made that move to pay for it first and, you know, just to make myself feel better. But then, you know, sometimes I don't want the celebrity to feel bad that I didn't accept their gift autograph. So, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
I think I paid for one autograph, and that was at ICCCC. Mm-hmm. Is that enough C's? 2022, when it was the last year at the hotel before I went back to the hotel. Mm-hmm. And it was Timothy Zahn. I paid $10 and I brought the Black Series when they had like the comic collection, and it was Luke Skywalker from Heir to the Empire. And he signed it in. It was $10. So he just signed it in there. I talked to him for about 10 minutes because it was early in the morning and no one else was there. And I'm like, this is cool. And then I think it was right before we met up with you guys from the hotel or from the house. And then we just like walked around, and because Tyler was looking for that Boba Fett or General Grievous.
Yeah. San Diego card thing. Gotten Boba Fett. Searched for that thing for months. And then
that's great.
Paid $250 for it.
For wait, you paid $250 for a Boba Fett action figure?
Yep. And then I think it dropped in price.
Which one was this?
It was San Diego Comic-Con exclusive.
It's the Black Series carded, like the silver foil.
Star Wars card Boba Fett.
Is that the most you've ever paid
for a single figure? Yeah.
Wow.
How much was it again? $350?
$250.
Oh, $250.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I think that was, I remember, because I had the extra one that right at about the time we were starting to get to know each other. And I remember being like, I don't know if I'm ever going to see this guy again. And then I sold it to someone for like $200. And then like all of a sudden we started hanging out more. And then I'm like, oh, crap, I probably should have kept it. Oh, well, I didn't think it was that big of a deal. Then the next year we were at, you know, or a couple of years later, we were at ICCC and you're looking for it. And you pay. I'm like,
You know, I want them all. I paid for a photo with Rosario Dawson.
Well, there you go.
A delight. I would do that again.
Sure.
And Frankie Muniz.
There you go.
Yeah. So $40, and he was awesome.
Yeah, he's he's driving the NASCAR Truck Series now.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, that's legit. He's very much a legit race car driver, and so yeah, he's driving.
They're coming back to do another season of Malcolm in the Middle on Disney Plus.
Yeah,
oh, I thought like I everyone's heard coming back. About that.
Yeah. My sister-in-law sold merch for his band when they would play in town. She was like, she'd head up the merch table.
Oh, well, that's a claim to fame.
Isn't that weird? Yeah. She would like hang out with him and like show us pictures and be like, oh, yeah.
So at the very first Star Wars Celebration, they did have a lot of celebrities there, but there was no autograph hall. So you can approach these celebrities if you happen to see them and ask them for an autograph. But there was no autograph hall. That's what gave birth to Official Picks. Is the guys who own Official Picks went to Star Wars Celebration 1, saw there was no autograph hall, and decided to fill the vacuum and create a business around it. So you can blame those guys for a lot for the high price of autographs today.
I would say if there was an autograph hall, it probably would have been underwater at Celebration 1 anyway. So
right, yeah, the stories about the rain there is crazy. Now, it's Star Wars Celebration 2 in Indianapolis. They did have the autograph hall. This was Official Picks. And autograph tickets cost a whopping $12 a piece. So, and some of these celebrities required maybe, you know, two or three tickets.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know. It pushed it up to like $36. Oh, my God. But it was $12 a piece. And they had about 35 celebrities there. And it was great, you know. It was just like really start filling up your collection at those prices. And I just remember, and I've told this story before, but I'm going to tell it again. Standing in line for Billy Dee Williams' autograph. And there was a lady behind the table with him, and she would ask your name if you wanted your photo personalized. She'd write your name down and write it on a post-it note and stick it on the photo or whatever you were getting signed.
Right.
So I'm in line behind this guy who has the 12-inch Lando Calrissian action figure in the box. This is from the 90s, mid-90s. In the box from Hasbro, and he wanted Billy Dee to sign it. So Billy Dee's he's getting ready to sign this guy's action figure box, and the lady next to him says, "What's the name?" And she looks at me, and I said, "It's Jim." So she writes it down on the post-it note. Meanwhile, while she's writing it on the post-it note, Billy Dee is signing to Jim on this guy's action figure box. And I was like, oh, no. And I felt so bad about it. But then I was like, you know what, man? This is not my fault. I can't be carrying around guilt over this. It's totally.
Was his name Jim, though?
Sadly, I mean, no. So, you know, to make it better, Billy goes, oh, no. And he starts scribbling out. You know, it's like, geez, man. So I don't know. I don't know how that got resolved with that particular fan. But it was a sad state of affairs. Phil Brown from the original Star Wars, Uncle Owen, he was signing autographs at this event. And so I got his autograph because I looked at the dude and I'm like, you better get his autograph like now.
Right.
Like, don't even wait for the third day of the convention. Get it now. Because he looked like, I don't know, He wasn't looking too good, but he gave me his business card, which I still have to this day.
That's awesome. Cool.
Yeah, yeah, and it was a lot of fun, and the celebrities were all pretty accessible. They were hanging out and everything, and same thing with Star Wars Celebration 3. Where they didn't do the tickets anymore, but I think they did do tickets, but there were different prices. There was a $20 tier, then a $10 tier, and like half of them signed for $20, the other half signed for $10. So, I mean, we're talking some, you know, pretty well-known names like Dave Prowse for $20, Kenny Baker, Ray Park, Jeremy Bullock, Tim Morrison. And Billy D signed for $30. So he was the one pricey one there.
Now, do you think kind of change the topic, but with Ray Stevenson, do you think he signed anything Star Wars related?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because no merch was out.
Yeah. Before.
He might have done a mail away or something.
He did appear at Star Wars Celebration Anaheim, if you remember. He was there, wasn't he? Was it Anaheim? No, it was the following one in London.
Yeah.
He was at that one.
Did he do autographs?
Well, he wasn't. I don't think he was signing. I don't think he was signing at a table because, like you said, they probably hadn't, you know, created any photos or.
He's probably the rarest Star Wars autograph.
Could be, but so people at that event may have snagged his autograph, you know.
But probably not on anything Ahsoka related.
No, I don't think there was anything.
He died before it came out, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You can get Jira's autograph. I mean, there was a window of time, but you can't get Baylan Skulls, so.
Yeah. Well, that's sad. I mean, they just recast him.
You can now. Recast Jira. It'll be a different guy, though.
Say what? Recast?
Jira. We got to bring her back.
Yeah, whatever happened to her?
I don't
Storm's,
know.
Like Storm's getting bad, honey.
Well, the current news is that they finally showed Watto's canon death in the comics.
Well, we don't know this yet because the comic hasn't been released yet.
Right.
And so the word is that there's going to be some flashback in this book called Legacy of Vader where Kylo Ren sort of is retracing Darth Vader's life or something, and he ends up on Tatooine, and maybe somebody tells him about Darth Vader killing Watto or whatever, but we don't know. We have no idea the context of this story, so a lot of people are jumping to conclusions.
The memes have been great, though. My favorite one is like all the flowers and photos put in front of Watto's junk shop. Like... Like the queen has died, and it's just his junk shop is just littered with messages from his fans.
It does sadden me that they like are killing him. Because I think there's, I don't know, just anytime they kill a Phantom Menace character off, I'm like, wait a minute, there's more. Man,
Captain Tarkles was the saddest death. I mean, he died for nothing. He's like, sacrifice. And then 5 minutes later, Padme's like, ah, we'll make the prisoner swap. We're good. I'm like, you could have ended the war, Padme. Come on. You had Grievous.
Yeah, don't forget, though, Watto and Attack of the Clones looked pretty, you know, not like in good.
When you think he died of luck? Complications?
He was like scruffy and just sort of whoa. Yeah, so you never know the lifespan of a Targaryen, though. So he could have been 300 years old for all we know. And was just,
That's right. I don't know. I have thoughts on that. I have thoughts on this whole thing. I'm going to save them for the weekly show, though.
Okay.
I'm not going to blow my load here with a Bob.
Yeah. Well, give us a shout out at least.
But I don't know if we could jump to conclusions about the tease that was released and what that really means. Because when you're talking about flashbacks, there's just so many different ways you could present a flashback, you know. It's like, I'm sure my grandfather really wanted to kill that green bird guy, that blue green bird guy. I bet he did. Wonder what that was like.
It could have been Watto the younger or something too. It could have been
that's true.
Oh yes, yeah. Watto the lesser.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe like Watto, his like twin brother or something Watto. That was there visiting from Toydaria because, you know, he was at the home. Maybe he was like, hey, I'm going to be the king now because king's name of Toydaria?
Katunko.
He's like, yeah, he's gone. I'm taking over. So, you know, your brother's going to be the king of Toydaria.
Jesus.
Oh, crap. Now he's dead.
That's a deep cut. King Katunko from the Clone Wars.
That's like Trading Places, right? Isn't that what's the movie where the king? I don't know.
So the last Star Wars celebration of the States was 2022. Can you guess who the most expensive autograph was at that convention?
Ewan?
Yeah, Ewan McGregor. $300.
Wow.
$300. Followed by Ian McDiarmid, $140. Where do you get off, Ian McDiarmid? Oh
my God.
I mean, come on. Your film career is basically one film, really, you know, Return of the Jedi. And I mean, I guess the prequels count too, but Ian McDiarmid, you know, talk about overrated. And then, well, I mean, he's been inaccessible for years, but if you went to any of his plays, you could just stand by the back door and hand him something to sign. But if it was Star Wars, he would tell you to shove it. So maybe that's what it's all about, you know? No, I only signed these for $140, you know, snob.
Not to change the subject quick, but it was something you guys were talking about earlier. Have you guys seen that documentary? I think it's on Max or Paramount Plus called, it's the documentary about Yacht Rock.
No.
Oh, my God. No. Basically, the end of it's hilarious because they call Donald Fagen.
Yeah.
He basically he asked him to be on the show. He's like, what's that documentary called? Yacht Rock. Yeah, you can go F yourself, and hung up.
Yeah, good for him. Good for him.
They had Kenny Loggins. They had Michael McDonald. They had all the Christopher Cross, all the guys that are associated with the term, and the guys from that comedy troupe that in the early 2000s, like, coined the phrase Yacht Rock and did all that stuff too.
So. Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole notion of Yacht Rock is rather nebulous in its definition, you know. It's very vague as to what actually is Yacht Rock. I sort of get it. I get it, you know. But
they get into it about the jazz stylings and stuff, but Steely Dan was pretty much like primary because of the way that they take jazz, like signatures and progressions and turn it into popular music. They're like people, they try to classify like Hall & Oates and Jimmy Buffett. Like, they're not yacht rock. They're just like more like R&B or could be easy listening. But it all depends on the style of the way that the music comes out. And there's a lot of stuff like people realize, like George Benson, he's yacht rock, but he's not rock because it's not. But they went a little bit more pop. And it was just interesting. It's just funny hearing all these guys and looking at somebody like how much like, oh, my God, Kenny Loggins. I don't know how much plastic surgery that guy has, but it's just like his face. He almost looks the same as he did 40 years ago, but just pulled back. Yeah, so
something wrong with that.
Is Max Rebo yacht rock?
Yeah.
I mean, that's played on a sail barge.
These are the important questions. These
he's barge rock.
Barge rock.
Which, by the way, I've got the Lego sail barge right back here with.
Oh, hey, look at that!
Wait, what's happening here? Sail barge. So this is Lego.
The Lego sail barge, and I also have the
Lego
25th anniversary. Oh yeah, it's a good 2 feet over. It's about 30 inches long.
Wow.
As she said.
So you keep it on the shipping container for the ghost? Is
I put it up there to keep it away from Mr. Dan the cat because he likes. I haven't found a place yet for that. That's the one thing I know at the collection room at the new house is going to have, we're trying to figure out a way to make it like one of those hidden doors, but also a door can't be left open accidentally. Cause I know that Mr. Dan, the cat, he's an orange cat and he totally acts like an orange cat. Sometimes will just jump and walk through the shelves and knock everything over. And I do not want that.
Son of a, you need a loft cat who would understand. would understand what it's dealing with. An orange cat, you're going into Heathcliff Garfield territory there. And
they're known as the assholes of the cat world. And he's the most lovable guy, but he also
That says a lot. If an individual type of cat can be considered the assholes of the cat world, because the cats are the assholes of the pet world. So that says a lot. That's a real achievement. I'm going to have to talk to some of my cat loving friends about that. Oh, you don't have an orange cat, do you? I've had cats. I've had some cats over the years, but currently, no, I don't have a cat.
I've never had a cat.
I've heard orange female cats are rare.
I think they're 20. Yeah, they're 20%. Males are like 80, and they're mostly males. So
interesting.
But it also depends on too. Like, Mr. Dan's mom was a calico, and his other people, like all the cats were all different colors.
So it wasn't like they were all orange cat. Mr. Dan's mom's a calico.
What did I just see recently with cats shooting laser beams? What was
laser
that?
Cats?
Yeah, what
laser
was
laser cats from some Saturday Night Live?
Digital Is that Saturday Night Live?
The SNL digital short. Yeah,
that was the first one I think that Andy Samberg wrote when he was on the show.
One of the first.
Oh, it's that old? I thought this was something. Maybe
it was probably on the documentary.
Yeah, maybe it was. Maybe it was.
Yeah, they did one every year. Yeah,
laser cats.
Laser cats. Yeah.
It's got a lot of Star Wars.
It sure does.
To it, yeah.
Sure does.
Steven Spielberg one's my favorite, where he cameos.
What is that?
One of the laser cats. Like it.
Wait, there's a series of laser cats.
Well, so the concept is they're pitching Lorne Michaels on laser cats to put it on SNL.
Yes,
and he like hates the idea.
Yes,
and then for one of them, they get Steven Spielberg to help out with it. But it's just as bad. And Steven Spielberg's like, they're in the Laser Cats universe running around with them.
All right. So this all happened about 10 or 12 years ago. Laser Cats.
Yeah.
But there's a video on YouTube. Every Laser Cats ever.
Yeah.
And it's part one of two is 13 minutes, and the second part is 18 minutes. So there's a considerable amount of laser cat content out there. Why do I think it's so new?
You know? I mean, relative to SNL, it's, I guess, new. It's from the,
there wasn't a whole lot of reason to watch SNL in those years.
That's true.
Andy Samberg was one of them. You should watch it for him.
Yeah.
I was going to say, because he's like, he did 8 seasons of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and that's been off the air for 3 years now. Mm-hmm, so that's 11 years that he's been not more off of SNL.
True. And he still feels like one of the newer castmates to me.
Well, I've been really enjoying the Seth Meyers Lonely Island podcast because they do like a digital short every episode behind the scenes, but then they go into like behind the scenes stories from that SNL episode. And, to be honest, I think I'm more interested in the behind the scenes stuff for SNL than the show itself. I went back and was like, let's watch the first episode. It's unwatchable. It's not holiday special bad, but a lot of it is.
Well, it's kind of dated. Yeah.
But yeah, for sure. But it is interesting from a historic perspective. But like you throw on a random SNL episode and it's got maybe like one funny sketch. But I get it because it's more interesting, the production behind it.
Well, that's why they have like the collection series of like all the different, like,
I love those.
Best of like, Chris
Best Farrow. Of an actor or something.
Yeah. Oh. That stuff is the best.
The Best of TV Funhouse is the best one. If you have to own anyone, that one's so good. Cause a lot of those aren't allowed on YouTube anymore. They're like, they're banned.
Well, they, those,
do you remember the,
those
remember
best of
TV Funhouse? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just, while we're talking about those best of specials, what I gathered off of the SNL documentary was that cowbell sketch with, the Blue Oyster Cult Cowboys. Everyone's familiar with that, right?
Yeah. Right.
The cowbell sketch with Christopher Walken, Blue Oyster Cult. That, it went over just fine as a sketch, but it didn't become a legendary one until they released The Best of Will Ferrell. Mm-hmm. And it was on there. And from that point, it became this this revered greatest sketch of all time sort of vibe. So, yeah, those best of shows can do a lot to like even like rejuvenate old materials. So.
And they've been doing that for a long, because I remember back in the early 90s, I had a VHS of the best of Eddie Murphy.
Oh, yeah.
And it had like James Brown, Celebrity Hot Tub, and Little Richard Simmons, and Mr. Robinson's Neighbor, like all of the Gumby.
Gumby, damn it.
All that stuff. I think Will Ferrell was on Jimmy Fallon recently, and he said that he went and saw Christopher Walken on Broadway doing something, and he went backstage afterwards, and he's like, "You ruined my life." They come for the curtain call, and always someone has a cowbell. And he goes, "I was at an Italian deli for my Italian food lunch, and they asked if I wanted more cowbell with my, you know, mozzarella bolognese or something." And he's like, everywhere he goes, they ask if he wants more cowbell.
Oh my God.
So it's just from one sketch.
Yeah, they said they asked him to be part of the documentary, Walken, and he refused to do it. And the reason he gave was that, you know, he doesn't like to spend time in the past. He likes to be forward thinking, and he doesn't like to look back. And I think that's a skill he developed after Natalie Wood died. I'm not looking in the past no more. You guys have, I guess you have to know that story about the way Natalie Wood died. She was on a boat with Christopher Walken and Robert Wagner. Apparently she was like a great swimmer and everything, and she fell off the boat and drowned. So it's very fishy.
I have a very loose connection to Lana Wood. You know her?
Yeah, I do. From the James Bond. She was Tiffany Case in Diamonds Are Forever.
She's friends with a family friend.
No, I'm sorry. Wait a second. I got to take that back because Bondcast listeners will jump all over me. She was not Tiffany Case in Diamonds Are Forever. She was Plenty O'Toole.
That's right.
That's who she was. Okay. Sorry. Yeah, sorry, Bondcast fans.
She's a friend of a family friend. And I did some like graphic design work for them, James Bond related. Mm-hmm. They would hold like James Bond dinner parties. And I think they invited her to one, and she saw the design work and she was like, "Oh, that's cute. I really like that." And then like our family friend like emailed me and he's like, "Lana Wood really likes your stuff." And I'm like, "Cool."
No. Oh man. She was smoking back in the early 70s. My God.
Yeah. I mean,
they called her Plenty for a reason.
She was probably 70 when she said that about
me. Yeah. Like, hey. Well, I bet still hot though. Probably.
Yeah.
Bond girls never age.
No. Look at Raquel Welch when she was like in her 70s. She still looked amazing.
That's right. So. She looked great in Rochelle. Oh, that's a Seinfeld.
Rochelle.
the
one
musical.
One woman's erotic journey from Milan to Minsk.
Rochelle. Yes.
Yeah, that was a long running thing too, right? Because there was the theatrical release, mm-hmm. and then I think it came out on VHS, and then there was a Broadway adaptation.
Right,
it was
show. Yeah, in one of the later seasons of Curb, Larry David brings it up, and somebody looks at him and goes, "What?" He goes, "It's from Seinfeld. You don't know Rochelle?" What? I think it was Susie Essman.
Death Blow was another Seinfeld movie, made-up movie.
To this day, I still want to see Sack Lunch.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how did they get in there? Enjoy Sack Lunch, that guy says to Elaine when they're going in all snooty to watch The English Patient.
I think Sack Lunch was a Larry David script that never got made.
Really? Are you kidding me? It's based in some sense of reality, Sack
Lunch?
Didn't
he do something else called Sour Grapes?
Yes, yeah. Now that was a film, yeah.
That title, I mean, Sour Grapes, Sack Lunch, it's got a kind of similar sort of.
Was Sack Lunch the episode where Jerry's girlfriend gets him in?
Yes, yeah. She can sweet talk her way into anything. So yeah. Enjoy Sack Lunch. Yeah, so that's one I still want to see, fictional or not. Get on it, Kathleen Kennedy, Sack Lunch. We want to see it.
They'll announce it. We have 15 exciting new projects.
Yeah.
From the universe of Seinfeld.
Sack Lunch.
Lucasfilm is now making Seinfeld films a reality.
It's an ILM. ILM will be presenting Sack Lunch to us.
Followed by Death Blow.
Probably be a hit.
Oh my God. Well, someone should ask them about that droids. What happened to that?
I mean, they mentioned it in 2020 at that investors spectacular roundup thing they had. And yeah, she said it, and then not a peep since then. Not even a peep about it.
Because it was supposed to be this like a 2-hour movie, wasn't it? It was just supposed to be like Disney Plus.
It was one of those things she called an event, so they didn't know what they were actually doing with it. It probably never gestated beyond the simple idea that Kathleen Kennedy came up with as she was walking onto the stage. That investors promotion. Yeah, I'm gonna just throw a droid's tail at them. Oh, they're going to love that. They're going to love that.
From ILM.
Yeah. Well, shouldn't we talk to somebody about, like, at ILM first? No. This is gold, Jerry. Gold.
Gold, Jerry.
I should make custom t-shirts of the logos for the things they never produced.
Right.
And wear them every day that I'm at the convention.
Well, you certainly will have a large wardrobe to take with you over to Japan, that's for sure. But
Rangers.
Well, I was going to say, even just from that call, they had Rogue Squadron and they had Rangers, the Legend of the New Rangers or whatever it was called.
Rangers of the New Republic.
Rangers, that's it. And then Droid's Tale. And
yeah. They haven't come on those since, though, have they? Where she's come out and just like blurted out all this stuff at us?
Well, she did. Yeah, it happened at the 2020 Disney Investor Day live stream thing where they announced The Acolyte, Rangers of the New Republic, the Willow series.
But that was the last time they did that, right?
Yeah.
Because that was during COVID. Because it was in the fall of 2020 or something.
It was December 2020.
Okay.
It was just like on the heels of, it was just right before the season 2 finale of The Mandalorian. And she announced The Acolyte, Rangers of the New Republic, The Willow series, a property they picked up called Children of Blood and Bone, A Droid's Tale, Lando, Ahsoka, the Taika Waititi film, a new Indiana Jones film, Star Wars Visions, The Bad Batch, and Andor. And so like 7 out of the 11 actually happened to various degrees of success or lack thereof.
Right.
But obviously Rangers of the New Republic got tanked because of the Gina Carano controversy.
I like Gino Carano.
Gino, hey, Gino.
Hey,
what
am I going to make this Star Wars? Come on, I'm ready.
Then Children of Blood and Bone, that capsized because the writer of that series was banging heads with Lucasfilm brass, most notably Michelle Rejwan, who was the person who brought that property to Lucasfilm.
And wasn't the showrunner that was the guy that directed a couple episodes from The Mandalorian. Well,
they threw him a bone and made him the co-showrunner for season 3 of Mando.
Right. Abu Dhabi. I'm trying to think of that guy's last name. Rick.
You have to say it like Kramer. Rick Famuyiwa.
He had more to do with season 3, you know, like he was really like the main guy running that thing because Filoni was off doing Ahsoka and Favreau was off doing Favreau things. And so season 3 of The Mando kind of suffered as a result, I think.
Yeah.
They also announced a Droid's Tale that never happened. The Lando thing is still maybe.
Yeah.
Every time you talk to Donald Glover brings it up saying, you know,
but what's it going to be like a Disney Plus exclusive movie, a miniseries? Like,
yeah, they've indicated it's now a movie, so it could be a Disney Plus only, or maybe they'll add it to the release schedule. I don't see that happening with so many other projects in the way, most notably the Simon Kinberg film, which is rumored to be talking to Henry Cavill to join that one, the Simon Kinberg. And then you, of course, have the Sean Levy. What else? The Sharmino Bain-Shanoy.
Mangold.
James Mangold. I mean, there's a lot of things clogging up the pipeline right now.
And I just want a clear direction. Like, for me, I like Star Wars when it's like, we're making a trilogy set in this era.
Yeah.
These are the only films we're getting.
That's what they should do.
We're moving back into this weird era of like Star Wars anthology where it's going to be like Mandalorian and Grogu, and then jump ahead 30 years for a Rey movie, and then jump ahead to wherever for this like other movie. And yeah, if they're making multiple Rey movies that aren't a connected trilogy, mm-hmm, that's ridiculous.
They don't want to do trilogies.
They need to.
Of course they do. That's part
Star
of the
Wars
DNA.
Is a trilogy.
That's part of the DNA of Star Wars. But they don't get it. Kathleen Kennedy just doesn't get it. So it's a hodgepodge of shit that they hope will work somehow. But general audiences have already revealed the Star Wars fatigue. And they're not going to stay on board for all this timeline jumping and all of these different characters and situations. They're just not going to do it. So it's really a recipe for destruction, I think. But they seem to be hell-bent on making Star Wars a series that's like the Marvel series, where it's just random, you know? It's random, and somehow
well,
they tie
that's
it all together.
That's what Marvel's become. Marvel's
yeah.
become random.
Yeah, because, extremely random.
I mean, Brian, I'm sure you could speak to this, but like there used to be a clear through line, and now they've made the commitment that the TV shows are standalone. The movies have a through line, but we've gotten so few movies that I can't recall the last one or what they're trying to set up. I don't think they're setting up anything.
No, and that's the thing too, is like even in the timeline for them since the Black Widow came out in 2021, the timeline in the movies has only progressed like 4 months. So that's what, and even like Deadpool and Wolverine, which was the only MCU movie that came out last year,
right,
isn't really in the MCU. In a sense, it's adjacent, and now they pulled them in. But other than that, it's just, I mean, we've got 4 coming out this year now because, what's it called? Captain America comes out in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Looking forward to that one.
Which really? Is so yeah. funny. I got the Happy Meal toy for that a year ago. Remember when they did the Happy Meal?
A year ago? Why?
Yeah.
Was it pushed back?
They had the Happy Meal planned, and then the movie was delayed a year.
Oh, it was delayed. Awesome.
It's because of the writer strike screwed everything up.
Oh, I see.
But yeah, this year you got that. You got Thunderbolts, which I'm actually, excited for because it takes a lot of the, it's almost like all the bad guys that are sort of good guys together. And then you got Fantastic Four, which I think we're going
to
get.
That's the one I'm looking forward to.
Well, yeah. They really need to nail Fantastic Four sooner or later because they're so important to Marvel. And,
first family.
So Thunderbolts, explain that. Yeah. Explain what is that supposed to be?
Thunderbolt. Well, Harrison Ford's character in Captain America, Brave New World is Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross.
Okay.
And that was, William Hurt played it before. And since, and
what movie was that with Hurt?
All of the, Civil War, that's
okay. All
right. Incredible Hulk, right?
Yeah, Incredible Hulk. He was it then, and then he turns into like
he shaved his mustache and turned into Harrison Ford.
Oh,
pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna grow a mustache and shave that sucker off right away. I hope that works for me.
The main thing it's speaking of Seinfeld, Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character takes basically like the guy that was Captain America in Falcon and the Winter Soldier and takes him and takes Bucky Barnes and takes Ghost from the Ant-Man series and takes, I can't think of her name now, Natasha's sister and
Florence Pugh.
Her and then David Harbour from Black Widow and takes all these ones that are sort of like good guy, bad guys. And it's like their Suicide Squad almost, but they're going in to do like the dirty work type stuff.
Yeah.
Why does the logo have an asterisk?
Because it's not associated with Thunderbolt Ross yet. So I guess they didn't know how they wanted to go ahead. It's a whole thing where it's like they don't really say because at the end of the first trailer it was Thunderbolts and then asterisk popped up. No one's really explained it, but they've sort of Feige's led hints to why it is. And because at that time it was when they were filming it, there was a flux between not knowing who Thunderbolt Ross was going to be. Oh, and then Harrison Ford came on there, so he might be more in play now to do more movies with them, but who knows?
It's a very complicated asterisk, if you ask me.
Yeah.
And probably does not bode well for the final film. I have a feeling of box office failure surrounding this film, just based on what you guys are telling me.
Well, even that upcoming Superman movie, I don't know if that's going to do well. I'm hearing mixed reactions.
I've heard nothing but great stuff until today, when people were upset about some footage that was revealed over the weekend.
Oh yeah, he was like
showing Superman flying, and they say he doesn't look right flying. His face looks weird. And his eyes are like Marty Feldman's. And
they did a fisheye lens, and it looks silly. He did that before with James Gunn did that in Guardians 3. It's a thing he does.
Oh, okay.
It looks goofy, but yeah.
Well, that doesn't sound good. But mostly I've heard a lot of positives about the Superman thing. The buzz has been good. People like the crypto showing up in there. And I'm not talking about cyber money. I'm talking about...
They changed the spelling so that they could cash in on that.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So there will be a crypto coin.
There will be. Well, I'll buy that up as much as I bought up the Hawk Tua money.
There you go.
And so she's now off the map since that happened. She's disappeared.
Yeah, she reminds me of that character you guys watched the season 2 of Squid Game.
Yeah.
Like that guy that sold the crypto and then it just went belly up and now everyone's out to kill him.
Yeah.
Like the Hawk Tua girl.
Maybe she'll be in Squid Game season 3. That would be a real boost for her career to be in Squid Game.
I liked Squid Game too. I thought that was a solid between watching that and then watching Skeleton Crew. It was kind of
I did too because it was sort of like I had no idea what was going to happen, and then especially the way it ended, I'm like, holy okay, well, it is what it is. And then because I tell you, like, as soon as they got like halfway through, I like the fact that, you know, a little bit of spoilers, but you know that the one guy that's in with them, you already know that he is in the game, but he is the guy running the game.
Yeah, like the first season. Like the first season. But I mean, this guy's a little more hands-on with the game, though. He's the man.
You know it the whole time that from the first season.
True.
You know that he is a plant.
Right.
Whereas in like the first season, you didn't know the old guy was, you kind of could figure it out by like the fourth episode.
Yeah.
But this one, it's like his motivations. What he's doing, and then especially at the end when he was like, I'm like, is he actually gonna help him? No, he walks around back and then just starts killing all the other guys.
Spoiler alert. You know, even though it's been out for a month, it takes people a long time to get caught up on this stuff. But you know, I think that's a great series. I really enjoy both seasons of that show. That's really strong stuff. And so season 3 of Squid Game is gonna come out later this year. It's like they took season 2 and just split it in half. Essentially,
it's like double the episode count at least, so that's good.
But
we've got good TV right now. I mean, I've been really enjoying Severance.
Yeah, that's a good
show. I loved season 1, really enjoying season 2. Invincible, the animated superhero show, comes out in a week. I'm excited for that. I don't know if you've seen that. If you like The Boys, you might like Invincible.
It has the same concept where you think the main guy is a good guy, and then you find out, like, speaking of J.K. Simmons, because he voices the one guy.
A lot of gray areas in that show, but I really enjoy that.
Yeah.
But we haven't talked about Skeleton Crew.
Yeah, Brian wanted to talk about it for sure. He mentioned that's the one thing he wanted to talk about at the beginning of the show. And And we've made it more than an hour without even bringing it up. But since you brought it up, Barry.
Okay.
So because Brian's asleep at the wheel, I'm going to let you talk about Skeleton Crew first. But let's get some final thoughts on Skeleton Crew.
Yeah, it was a happy surprise for me. I was not expecting much from it. I was expecting, you know, at least a decent to solid show, but overall, it was just like it's kind of like what I want Star Wars TV to be moving forward.
Yeah.
I don't, as much as I actually did like Kenobi and Book of Boba Fett, like, and even Ahsoka to an extent, like, I want those stories told on the big screen if they're going to be involving Hayden and Ewan and even Tamora Morrison. Like, tell side stories on Disney Plus. Like, you know, I thought it was really great to have an encapsulated event season that could have a season two, but doesn't need one. I think it did a lot of things right that Acolyte did wrong. I think the biggest thing Acolyte did wrong was leaving a lot of loose threads, thinking they were going to get a season two, which, to be fair, I think the Lucasfilm of old under George would have been like, whatever George wants to make, he'll make.
Of course.
Screw anyone else. But right. Now we're under the Disney regime where it's like, we need to be afraid about even Mandalorian getting continued. You know, like, it's just wild, the cost cutting and like the way it operates now. So
my biggest issue with Acolyte with all those loose threads was,
yeah,
it's not, I don't blame Leslie Headland as much as I blame Lucasfilm. They should have known going into it that a season two wasn't a sure thing.
Yes,
but I believe they led the showrunners to believe that this will go on for three seasons. Don't worry about it. Tell your story. And they did it that way. And
I'm so glad Skeleton Crew didn't do that.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
I think that's I was iffy on the show throughout because I'm like, if this ends with like an unresolved open whatever, I'm like, I'm going to be so upset. But I think it ended the perfect way because, you know, everyone had their happy ending and Jod didn't get killed, even though I agree with Jason. He's a dick. Like, I really was. But I think any character on screen that starts threatening, like, parents and children, like, I'm just done with them. Like, you know, I'm like irredeemable.
Made some comments about John, like, really crossing the line when he held the knife up to the girl's neck.
Yeah.
And I'll be damned if people didn't start responding on like the RFR Facebook group and stuff going, Jimmy thought that was a big deal. I don't see what the big deal was. What's the big deal about that? You know, it's like, dude, think about it. Use your flipping head and think for a second. If a 50-year-old man grabs a 12-year-old girl and holds a knife up to her neck, you don't think that's a big deal?
And he did it twice in the series or three times, mm-hmm. right?
Well, with the knife, too. Just the one time, really. But he was just pointing a lightsaber in their face, which is.
And he's got force powers, too. So he doesn't really, I mean, that's even like on top of it, and the fact that he's overpowers them. So.
But I will say, like, Jod's kind of doing what I think they were trying to do with Dr. Aphra. But instead, they just ran away with her and now think everyone like loves Dr. Aphra. And I'm like, I still hate her. I want her death to come quick and swiftly.
Dr. Aphra is the sales figures have never been good with that book. Regardless of what any journalist or fan or Lucasfilm wants you to think, that's never so. And the writer of that series, Alyssa Wong, has never had any sort of mainstream comic book success ever. But yet Lucasfilm keeps hiring these sad sack writers to work on their projects, and it doesn't pay off. Now, the High Republic may have been okay as far as a novel series and gained its fans that way, but as a comic series, the High Republic has been it's going to bankrupt Marvel Comics if they keep rolling that stuff out. Nobody buys those books.
When I was at C2E2 with Tyler, I think we saw Alyssa Wong there, didn't we?
Yeah.
And I had a little audio recorder from my work, and so we did an impromptu, like, 2-minute podcast, and I don't know what happened to that audio. But
I thought you were going to start playing it for us.
No, but you remember that, Tyler? Yeah, I brought it out, and we were like, hey, we're here in Artist Alley. Let's see what we got. And we're like, hey, look, it's the Aphra lady.
Yeah, like, do you want to go talk to her, Barry?
And I was like, no.
So what did you ask her? I mean,
we didn't.
We walked over and looked. We were nice. We looked at the books, but it was just kind of like.
No, I'm talking about your interview.
Oh. I think we were just goofing. We were just goofing. Nothing interesting.
You guys.
I know. I'm sorry.
You know, whatever I say about High Republic, I still am going to read that final novel, though. Charles Soule's writing it.
They had a big thing about that today. Like,
I saw that. Trial of the Jedi. Yeah. And I just like what Soule was saying about the book and the story. And it seems kind of interesting to me. So I'll be on board for the finale.
Well, give High Republic credit for ending. You know, like no, like there's not a loose thread.
No, they went through their whole process. They even said like they hit all the beats and everything. And it might not have been received as they thought it was going to, but it went from the start to the finish the way they had planned for it to do it. So at least they got that out of done.
Well, it was heavily documented about how they were having all those meetings and laying out these stories. Right. And
no wars.
The architecture behind it. Oh, yeah, no wars.
No stars.
No stars, no wars. But let's call it Star Wars anyway.
Right.
But, yeah, I'll still read that because, you know, I've dipped my toe in and out of the High Republic stories and stuff, but it just it never grabbed me. It never did. Like it grabbed Brian Klein.
You know,
who's like the only guy I know who's read all of the, but Brian, of course, we know that he doesn't read, he absorbs. That's the way he's so prolific as far as all the content he consumes. Because he just,
for audiobooks,
he just soaks it in. It's like how a sun gets, you know, the chlorophyll and from the sunlight, you know, in the plants. And, you know, that's like how Brian's like a plant. He's not a plant who eats Jedi, though, like he's in the plant. High Republic. So, yes.
The Drengir.
He's our plant. Our plant, Robert Plant.
What did our plant think of Skeleton Crew?
Yeah, Brian Klein.
Well, the first thing I have to say was at the end of it, this is I've talked about it on two other podcasts and
it doesn't matter
calling.
They don't exist when you're behind, when you're behind this mic, no other podcast matters. Not even the one with Swank.
I kept calling him Jadna Nawood and it comes out and it's like Sha-na-na, you know, the 70s doo-wop group. And every time I would hear that name, it's like, but I was thinking about it too. It's like he sort of has some parallels to Hondo Ohnaka as well, because he's a pirate. He plays both sides. I mean, he's comes across as one way, where Hondo, there's so many times, like after, like in the Clone Wars, like the Jedi, the next time they see him, they should be arresting him for what he did the last time they saw him, like leaving him high and dry and like basically backstabbing them. But no, he's Hondo. He's not quite as, he's definitely not as redeemable as Hondo was. But don't forget, he did that stuff with the kids when they were going to Ilum to get their Kyber crystals. You know, he kidnapped those kids, but you don't see any kind of like redeeming factors. Although when the mom pulled the switch to lower the whatever they call it, the containment field, he basically was just like, I lost and let them go. Like he even said a couple of times in that last episode, I do not want to kill anybody.
Right. Yeah.
And I think he meant that.
Yeah, I do too.
But the one thing that this show was so good at was with those kids, especially, was they made you like a lot of the characters, they made you care about them and they made you be like, oh my, I mean, how many times was KB going to die? And
yeah, right.
Like, and it could have been like, seriously, you had no, at the end of it, it could have been like Rogue One, because you never saw these characters later. Obviously, we don't know that in the timeline yet, but they could have all died. Everyone, the whole planet could have blown up. I like the premise of these at planets, whatever you want, however many there are, being, you know, the function that they had, which was still a little bit vague, but it was, you know, how Atten was the depository and it's hidden and there's all these thousands of, holy crap, there's a lot of gold and stuff there. But just the character development, and it was fun. It obviously had a lot of direct ties to Goonies, like that scene where they were, you know, when they were on the planet with Tak Rennid's vault underneath and they were sliding down the slide. And it was basically just like when the Goonies went to find and they hit the water, they hit the ship. But I mean, Neil as a character, oh my God, that guy was just like, I want to have like a friend with him, like in real life, because that character was just so, just that scene where he, they shut down 33 and he gets so excited, he just passes out. It was just like, I don't know. It was fun. It was enjoyable. Like Barry said, it was one of the things you wanted to see. I'm glad that it wasn't like at the end, when the Republic came and all of a sudden you would have seen like, oh, one of the X-Wings was flown by like Wedge Antilles, or even if they brought in some of the guys from Mandalorian, it just, you didn't need that. The Republic was there. You've got a little bit of, I mean, the only tie we had was, what was it? Vane or Kane or whatever the guy's name was, who was part of the Swamp Man guy in Mandalorian. Yeah,
I thought that was a kind of a fun connection though, because it was kind of like the equivalent of seeing the bounty hunters from Empire Strikes Back in Jabba's palace. You know, it wasn't a major cameo, but it was a nice, like, connective tissue. So you're like, all right, I got it. Yeah.
Because he was like, he was part of that guy's pirate crew, and then he got shot down, and he's like, I'm out of here. So he just went and joined another pirate crew.
Right.
That was about it. So, yeah, at the end of the day, I could see that, you know, them having the story tied up. But it also, it reminds me of how the end of, like, A New Hope ended. It ended. It didn't need to have a sequel.
No.
But there's groundwork there that it could. It could keep going.
Right.
But in what capacity? It's not going to be like they're lost again or they can't find their way home. But in the way that they even show these kids now, like on the press junket, they already look a lot different than their characters growing up.
For sure.
You know? Yeah.
That's the brilliance of making it also self-contained, is the fact that continuations are really difficult when you're dealing with actors of that age.
I'd love to see a continuation, but like wait a little and then show them in their new careers in the New Republic.
That where could you happen. Could have,
because think of the age that Wim is. He's basically 5 years older than Poe Dameron would be in Force Awakens, right?
Oh, I guess. Yeah, if you're looking at the sequel. Because
Poe was conceived after the Battle of Endor.
Yeah.
And Wim.
So Wim's like 7 years older. He's like, what is he, like 11 or 12?
So he's close to 11 or 12,
I mean, they're doing that Rogue Squadron movie, and if that takes place and Poe Dameron's in it, they could have an adult Wim.
You could have adult Wim, sure.
I don't know if I want them to do that. I kind of like, I like these actors so much that kind of like with the people were saying, oh, they're going to have an old Rey. And I'm like, no, let us earn old Rey. I want an old Daisy Ridley. I don't want an old actor playing. It's kind of reverse Solo, you know, like you're making a Solo movie. Harrison Ford's still alive, but you're recasting him as a kid. Give us an old Harrison Ford movie, you know?
Yeah.
Same thing with Rey. Like Daisy Ridley's, you know, alive and well and in her prime. Don't give us an old Rey movie.
Right. You know, fix the sins of the past with Star Wars.
Right.
When George shut the whole thing down, when he still had the actors in their prime, you know, he just needed to.
And that's the thing too about, and we've talked about this almost, you know, ad nauseum here, is that when you do stuff in, like with the prequels, you've got characters like Obi-Wan and Anakin that, you know, aren't going to die in these movies because they're in stuff later. So if you have a old Rey movie, anything she goes after, you know, like Rise of Skywalker till then, you know, she's going to be fine because she's alive.
That's true. It's plot armor.
Yeah. So it's sort of just like, and then you also have to get in one thing that I think from reading from people talk about when it comes to creating new content is there is that the canon, and especially Star Wars fans, as we should know, you have to stay so true to the minutia of everything that is said that you can't, I mean, I always think about the Evan Peele thing, but that was a whole different story because there was the G canon and then there was the other
that was
stuff.
George just anything like doing what he wanted to,
Is it's all supposed to be canon. Yeah. And, you know, especially like it was fun watching the Clone Wars, knowing that Grievous and Anakin never met. So there would always be like, even the times they were together, they were both passed out and they got dragged by each other. It was like, well they were there, but they didn't recognize it.
Our man died. Yeah.
Tarples.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of flexibility in the canon. Like I think people like to put out that there's these rules, hardcore rules that people follow and stuff, and like all these like throwaway lines of dialogue. But time and time again, we found a way around it.
Kenobi was a great example of that, where he's like, well, the last time, you know, and you're like, oh yeah, the last time was on the Death Star. And you're like, oh wait, no, you know, like, or the last time was on Mustafar. No, the last time was,
There are some things that they need to adhere to. Don't get me wrong.
But. Yeah, that's true.
But that's the thing is though, when something is said or done, like, you know, the last time, like the Dooku Anakin line. So now they're in that whole point or they have to adhere to that because they're doing something beforehand. Or even like in the, I don't know how much like in the comics, that's why I think like all the Mando comics that are coming out, those are just like retreads of the stories.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
because they can't put it, they don't want to put any new information out there, yeah, because that affects the story writing for the stuff they've got going forward.
I think that's per Favreau. I think, yeah, which I think fine, they were least, attempting to do something like that. I think
John, they don't want Pablo getting his fingers all over.
Yeah, though. Right. Exactly.
He's still there.
Yeah,
he's still making there. A book. There's a new reference guide coming out, I think, for Acolyte.
These people, they get their foot in the door at Lucasfilm, and they stay there for their entire lives. And they get crusty and stale, and so does Star Wars. They really need to refreshen a lot of the blood in those hallways in San Francisco, or better yet, shut down San Francisco, move the whole operation to Southern California so Disney can keep an eye on what's going on with Star Wars. They're like out on some island somewhere pretending George Lucas still runs the company. He doesn't. He doesn't, hasn't for a long time. And stop pretending you're George Lucas. They really need to flush that place out and freshen
this
it up.
This town needs an enema.
Especially because their chief, the chief creative officer now is, you know, Filoni. He doesn't need to have all these other people because he knows everything as far as what the vision and stuff is, and can even tell you, like, you know, what needs to go here or this. You don't need to have all this extra micromanaging going on.
Right.
With all the people. I don't even know. All I know is Pablo on the, they even still have the story group.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What it's called.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They you know? Still operate under. Under the guise of the story group, and the story group is terrible. So
that was Leland Chi part of that, or is he?
Yeah, he's part of that. He's basically a guy who just puts it all on a spreadsheet, and when people say, "Hey, will this contradict that?" then he looks it up and says, "Well, no, we already told that story. You got to find something else to do." I mean, that's basically how it works.
Leland Chi's cool though, right?
Oh, he's always been a nice guy. He's always been very friendly to RFR over the years, and he's been a listener for a long time. You know, he's approached me and brought up things we've talked about on the show, and he seems quite entertained, maybe even bemused by RFR at times. But yeah, he's always been a nice guy. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. He was the one who confirmed that Neil wasn't in Ortolan back in July, which Collider apparently didn't pick up on.
I know some fans were disappointed by that, but if you look at Max Rebo, he has a face that's really there's no expression to it whatsoever. He's got these little tiny black eyes.
He's got Greedo eyes.
Yeah, it just doesn't work for a main character, you know. So,
and I know you think he has feet. I don't think he has feet.
Why do you think he doesn't have feet? Because of Maquette?
No,
that was made during the concept. No.
The puppet sitting on a pillow.
It's wrong. It's so wrong. It's so wrong to think that way.
Yeah, if you know anything about music, Max Rebo plays with his feet.
No.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're anytime you have that and you're playing with like a keyboard type thing, piano, you're doing a lot of stuff with pedals with your feet.
It's
too.
No,
that's
it's
right.
Classic art. No, barge rock does not use pedals.
Now, Max Rebo has been depicted many times with feet.
They've made that cushion like his diaper, though. That thing he's sitting it's on, not like, oh, that's his little diaper.
No cushion. There's not even a cushion. Where do you even see a cushion?
He's sitting on a cushion in Jabba's palace. The puppet they made looking like it had feet, but then when they put the puppeteer's arms in it, they looked like arms because they didn't put feet inside them.
Yeah, the Lego minifigure has feet.
I think it's ridiculous. It's cool. He can have feet. He has feet if you want him to have feet.
He has feet regardless. He has feet.
Who is that? You know,
there's an action figure. There are two action figures of
remember
Max Rebo.
Remember the action figure for the special edition alien that replaced Wolfman? And you can take his pants off, and he's got tiny little stubby feet standing on robot feet.
Yeah.
That is the weirdest thing.
That is weird. So you're saying this is like some cushion he's sitting on?
Not the Jabba's Palace one. This one, they move the arms up.
Oh, is this? This is from Book of Boba Fett, I guess.
Yeah,
I guess.
The Jabba's Palace one, the arms start down here, but when the puppeteer put it in, it looked like they were coming out from the top. But even then, he doesn't look like he has feet there, does he?
There's been countless.
He's sitting inside the console.
Yeah, he's sitting there.
But what's that little? I don't know.
That's his like.
I mean, next, how would he get around?
Next time you see him, just grab him and pick him up and see what's under there. That's, see, this, you know, people this ask kind you, of stuff. What really... would you do if you were in the Star Wars universe? I'd say I'd hunt down Max Rebo and look at his feet. That's what I'd do.
All right, I'm going to forget. I'm going to forget we even had this conversation.
Did I just kill the Babu Freaks? It's over. You're like, yeah,
it's over.
So what's on Patreon, Jimmy? Oh, the final Babu Freak.
Starting next month. The Babu Freaks is going to be reformatted. It's going to be a three-man show called The Rebo Freaks. And we're just going to talk about nothing but Max Rebo. It's going to be really groundbreaking as far as Star Wars podcasting goes. And a lot of people are going to be saying, why didn't I think of that? It was great having you around, Barry, but this is what the show is going to be looking like from now on. Three guys talking the words. We can't leave Barry on the sidelines. If we did that.
Power trios are always better.
They're Max Rebo specialist.
Yeah.
All right.
The original Max Rebo band was only, you know, Cy, Droopy, and Max.
Hey, come on. Yeah, Max, you know, the Freaks were formed around trivia, and the big trivia question was how many members are there of the Max Rebo band, and we got that right.
Ooh, mm-hmm. that's a tough one.
The original is three, but then
when you get into the special edition, you have the singer, you have the the two drummers.
Yep, the three dancers.
Well, I guess they do count because they do back.
Yeah, that's Jai Yauza. And then
the harmonica guy.
The Rodian guy that plays like the clarinet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got him and Abith.
And Abith.
Abith,
yeah.
And then the three women, right? There's three.
Right, yeah, right. We mentioned them, the you know, backup singers.
I remember one of the drummers' name is Umpus Day. I just remember, like I said, I remember when we were answering this trivia question, is Jimmy and I were going through the action figures from the two, like, Max Rebo special edition Kenner play sets. Yeah. They had, like, the one with the three guys or six guys and one with, like, five or six.
Rapper Tune was the...
The harmonica player.
Harmonica guy, yeah.
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 That's a good band.
Rapper Tune, and then Jai Yowser was the...
Right.
Did you like his solo stuff or...
Earliest part of his career, his first couple albums. But after that, it got too weird in that disco era.
That's true.
Once Peter Green left the band, mainstream.
They totally abandoned their blues roots, and I was really pissed off about that. The whole Max Rebo band too.
Yeah.
All right. On that note, we're going to wrap this sucker up. So that's going to do it for the Babu Freaks this time around. We did some skeleton crew. What else did we talk about? Help me recap.
SNL.
We talked about some SNL. We talked about some Seinfeld. Yeah. We talked about Star Wars. So we did talk about Star Wars, right? Yeah, I think
High Republic and some of the...
Yeah, we talked about High Republic. Yeah. Things that never get talked about on the weekly show. That's why I like this show. I can talk about things that we don't normally talk about on the weekly show.
The one thing I did want to say about the current SNL, the only thing I find funny every week almost is Weekend Update with Colin and Michael Che.
Right.
Especially when they do their bit where they read each other's jokes that they wrote.
Oh, that got dirty.
Always kind of off color a bit, where it's like a white guy can't say this if it's a black guy joke, but Michael Che wrote it for him, and it's sort of like, oh, you're gonna get me killed if I say this.
True. Yeah. So, that's
good. Those are the only funny parts.
The past week with Timothy Chalamet, that's how you say it. Yeah, it was pretty good.
I did like that intro where they did like the fake award ceremony, because he always keeps not getting nominated and losing. And so he's like, I have this speech read, and then Kenan Thompson won the award anyway. So.
Yeah, during the monologue, But, you know, he did a real good job, and he performed, and you know, James Mangold, he's going to be a Star Wars director, maybe, if they can ever get the Dawn of the Jedi show off the ground. But his Bob Dylan movie is really good. I really liked it a lot. And I'm a Bob Dylan fan, so I was a little nervous about it going into it. But I thought it was a very good movie. And
I didn't know the whole Chocolate Factory part of it. But
the whole what? Chocolate Factory?
You watched the wrong one.
I did.
Yeah. And what was the deal with those? Okay. What was the deal with those giant worms out in the desert? I thought that was kind of weird too. But hey, whatever. You know, I mean, Bob Dylan's past is at times mysterious. So you just
did you hear the story about how he came on set a couple times and when they were filming scenes, he would like mess around with the people, tell them that this is how it actually happened, and so they'd start. And he's like, "I'm kidding. It's not." Then he like was fucking around, messing around with them. I mean, it's Bob Dylan. You're thinking he's like, you know, Bob Dylan doesn't have a sense of humor. I guess he's got a really great
sense of humor. He always has. I mean, and he is a troll. There's no question about it. He does love to mess with people. So, I mean, he's told so many stories about his own personal past where he's really, you know, fictionized a lot of, you know, his life. And they make mention of this in the film, too. They make a point of it where, you know, it's like he'll say something about his past and then like Joan Baez will be like, "Oh, you're full of crap." And then he doesn't deny it or agree with her or anything. It just leaves it to the audience to decide.
It's like, you choose. Did you see the We Are the World documentary that's on Netflix?
Only just a little bit of it. I've been meaning to come back to that one.
There's a good bit at the end there because Stevie Wonder, actually, Bob Dylan couldn't figure out how to sing his part because he didn't want to sound too much like Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
So Stevie Wonder went up to him and said, "You have to do it like the We Are the World." Like, you have to sing it like Bob Dylan because you have the soul. And he was like totally freaking out about it.
Yeah.
So it was pretty funny.
Yeah. I think Bob's really uncomfortable being in situations where like he isn't the guy who wrote the lyrics or devised the whole setup with the song and everything. So I think he gets a little freaked out by that, you know, because he's really a guy who, I mean, you know, doesn't really collaborate with many other lyricists or anything. And
I did see him interviewed one time where they asked him, because he's written the greatest American singer songwriter of all time. He goes, "Is there ever one song that is out there that you wish you would have written?" And he said one, and it was "Everlong" by Foo Fighters.
Strange.
Most random thing.
That is random. Yeah.
He goes, "It's the simplest song," but he goes, "There's something about it that is like, damn, I wish I wrote that song."
So that's interesting. I do recommend A Complete Unknown to anyone who hasn't seen it yet. Even if you're not, you don't consider yourself a Bob Dylan fan, it's really an excellent movie. So go see it. And so that's going to wrap things up for the freaks this time around. We got extended freak out. And I'm happy to provide that. It's always great to catch up with you guys. Guys like Tyler Page.
Hey, hey.
Barry Arvin.
Hey, hey.
And Brian Klein.
Hey, hey.
I'm Jimmy Mack.
Hey, hey. Hey, hey.
You know, I'll do a Fat Albert.
Hey, 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 hey.
Yeah, but see, that's the problem. Fat Albert does three hays. Yeah. And Babu Frick only does two hays. So how can the two actually coexist? I don't think it can happen. So I'm not going to try that again. I'll give you a solid,
hey, hey,
authentic Babu Frick style. All right, so that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with more Babu Freaks next month. Until then, always remember...
Hey!
Hey! Freak out.
Hey, hey!